KUOW's The Record. I'm Bill Radke. Thank you for tuning in. You know, we talk a lot about how Amazon's growth affects us in Seattle, where they're headquartered, but Amazon has opened fulfillment centers and warehouses and data centers all over the country. They're, of course, exploring a whole new second headquarters. That growth has come with the help of the American taxpayer. Taxpayers have spent $1.2 billion to help Amazon thrive. Reporter Casey Coombs with the Puget Sound Business Journal has been working to uncover the Amazon playbook on this front. Casey, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Get nice up close to that microphone, would you? How did taxpayers end up paying $1.2 billion to help Amazon open fulfillment centers and data warehouses around the country?
Yeah, as you mentioned, Amazon has built out a massive network of data warehouses and warehouses to store inventory that you buy on Amazon's website over the past 10 years. And the far majority of that has come online in the past 2 years and continues to ramp up. And as we see from Amazon's HQ2 request for proposals, incentives are a big part of opening new offices in new towns.
HQ2, I just want to let listener know you're referring to the headquarters number 2 that Amazon is now exploring, throwing it open to the continent.
Yes, and warehouses are no different. When Amazon goes into a new state, city, county, they look for incentives to lower the cost of doing business. And over the past 10 years and, you know, really in the past couple of years, they've accumulated about $1.2 billion in incentives by our count.
And you describe in your piece how Amazon gets cities to compete against one another.
Yeah, Amazon really has this down to a science, the negotiating strategy of going in and setting up these massive warehouses. They come in really quietly. They use real estate experts, some in Seattle, other developers around the country, to look for the sites that they want, make sure they have the right workforce, the right land, and they're all under NDA in this process. And then when Amazon's ready, they pick
NDA, non-disclosure agreements.
Yes. Amazon reaches out to the local city officials or economic development officials, and also very secretive under NDA, says we want the site and we want to build it in this amount of time. We're also considering this other, your neighbor here. What can you give us to sweeten the deal so that we decide to choose your site? And in more times than not, these cities, you know, give them millions of dollars in incentives. And at that point, Amazon says, okay, we're ready to go, and pushes through at lightning speed to get this built. And along the way, gets more concessions and more incentives.
What's one example? Give me a city where this has played out in an interesting and illustrative way.
So Miami-Dade County is a really good example. Amazon leased an 855,000 square foot fulfillment center, much like we have down in Kent. And during negotiations, elicited about $6.5 million in incentives, and they were able to negotiate an exception to pay responsible wages, which is a minimum set by the county for these public type projects.
So they were able to pay less money per hour than they were supposed to under the city's own rules?
Yeah, and we spoke with one of the top economic developers who's in on negotiations, and he said it turned boardrooms into a pressure cooker. They were the fastest, most high-pressure negotiations he's ever been on. And while they didn't bend the rules, he said that they really strained to keep within protocol and to meet all of Amazon's deadlines. And the inspector general for Miami-Dade County came in after the deal was done. She was there throughout the deal and did kind of an audit and came to the conclusion that they may have given away too much, you know. The wages, average wage started out about $37,000 for all employees, down, you know, to $27,000 is at the end of negotiations. And the employee headcount, you know, that was in the thousands, and it ended up being about 1,000 that Amazon promised in exchange for the incentives. So just this really fast negotiations and incentives piling up.
Well, how typical is that, that a city gives away too much? Because, of course, cities offer subsidies because they think they'll more than pay for themselves in new tax receipts.
Yes, and Amazon, there's no question that Amazon is, you know, they're bringing a lot of jobs and a lot of economic activity. And you know, the cities definitely have an economic benefit that they're getting out of it. But the way Amazon comes in very secretive and everything is under non-disclosure agreements and moving so quickly, cities don't really have a chance to sit down and evaluate, you know, are we giving too much? Do we have to give away the entire ranch to get this to come here? You know, in many cases, Amazon has decided to come into these locations no matter what.
So now cities all over North America are submitting proposals to Amazon to try to be the mother of all cities of Amazon growth, try to convince Amazon to open its second headquarters there. How's Amazon using that competition to its advantage?
Well, I mean, it's kind of ingenious in a way. Amazon has crowdsourced the, you know, proposals for its second headquarters and let all of the cities across North America do the legwork for them. They don't have to go out and negotiate with each individual city. They know that they have a massive project with a lot of jobs and the cachet of a big technology company. So they are basically letting, you know, cities and counties across North America hand over all of the data and more. I mean, really up the incentives to compete against others and, you know, give some outlandish perks to draw Amazon to town.
Well, yesterday, in fact, Amazon's worldwide consumer CEO, Jeff Wilke, said that Amazon's second headquarters isn't going to be here. It's not going to be in the Pacific Northwest, even though King and Snohomish counties, City of Tacoma, they've all been submitting their proposals to compete for it. How surprising was that that Wilke said, forget it, we're not opening another headquarters in this region?
Well, I think it was most surprising when that kind of hit home when they announced that they were looking for a second headquarters. We kind of saw the writing on the wall then, but Wilke having confirmed it yesterday, you know, it's a big blow to the region. I mean, it's essentially saying to the outside world, Amazon thinks this region is kind of tapped out for continued growth of this size, and, you know, it's doesn't look good to when we're trying to attract all of these other high-tech companies and, you know, headquarters from Silicon Valley and other companies around the world.
The reporting you did on Amazon was in partnership with 40 other business journals around the country.
Right.
What do you want the cities and towns competing for HQ2, that second Amazon headquarters, to learn from this reporting?
Well, I think it's important for the cities not to give away too much. I mean, to really evaluate what they have, what their assets are, and not drain the bank with incentives trying to get Amazon, because incentives actually come late in the negotiation process. Amazon first looks for a reliable workforce, infrastructure, all of these, you know, foundational elements to go in with the headquarters or warehouses. Incentives are toward the end of the deal. And don't get me wrong, they're still important, but I think what we're seeing with a lot of the HQ2 proposals is cities are just bending over backwards to, you know, offer tens of millions, you know, it's likely going into the hundreds of millions of dollars to lure them into town when, you know, they may not have a chance in the first place.
The Seattle area didn't have to lure Amazon in. It started in a garage in Bellevue, right? So what kind of subsidies does the Seattle region, if any, give Amazon?
Well, Washington State doesn't have a budget like many other states to give these kinds of big incentives for relocating companies to the area. And neither does, I mean, we don't have that at the county or the city level. So Jeff Bezos initially chose Amazon, the headquarters here in the Seattle area, because Washington has such a small population and the tax structure.
Why is a small population helpful?
A small population because, let me compare, if Amazon had put its headquarters in California as an e-commerce company, putting all of their real estate there would have required them to collect taxes from, you know, relative to proportionate to the population, to pay taxes relative to the population. Washington has a very small population, and the tax structure is such that they were able to pave, you know, a bare minimum of taxes.
Okay.
That's why you see, you know, e-commerce companies like this kind of basing in, not in huge populous cities and states.
Okay, so that was one consideration, relatively small population.
Mm-hmm.
No income tax?
No income tax. I mean, it is a pretty friendly business climate in a lot of ways here for companies to relocate. I mean, land was very cheap back then, and that's going to be another big consideration for Amazon moving to a new place. The real estate today is quite expensive, as we all know, and in part, in you know, a big part of that is Amazon attracting all of these high earners to the area.
So do you see the Seattle region eventually, you know, Washington State is famous for giving Boeing a huge tax break. Do you see Washington State or the Seattle area eventually becoming one of those cities that gives away major tax breaks or other subsidies to keep Amazon here instead of moving to HQ2 or any place else they want to?
Well, the legislators would have to drop some new laws to make that happen. I've spoken with the Department of Commerce and quite a few economic development officials around the state at from city, county, state level, and it doesn't sound like there's a huge tax incentive package waiting for Amazon like there was with Boeing. At this point, I'm not hearing that. Amazon does still plan to grow here. We need to keep that in mind. I mean,
yeah, they're moving into a new skyscraper.
Yeah, 722,000 square feet skyscraper they're filling up in their latest, you know, real estate project, and they still have, you know, about 2 million square feet to grow in total in the Seattle downtown, and that right there is, you know, comparable with the biggest project, any biggest project going on around the country. So
amazing.
Amazon's not pulling up stakes and leaving.
Yeah.
They still have a lot of growing here to do.
Casey Coombs, reporter for the Puget Sound Business Journal, has been tracking how Amazon enlists the help of the taxpayer here and there around the country as they grow, especially in the Seattle region, but all over and who knows where in headquarters number 2. Casey Coombs, thanks for this.
Thanks for having me.
You can read the reporting Casey and his fellow Business Journal reporters did online. We're tweeting out a link to that right now at KUOW. More of The Record coming up. On with KUOW's The Record. For the first time in 31 years, the U.S. men's soccer team will not be going to the World Cup. Shockingly, they got knocked out last night, and we have a Seattle Sounders player to partially thank for that. Soccer writer Stephen Agin is the Seattle editor for the soccer website Prost America and host of the podcast Radio Cascadia. Stephen, welcome to KUOW.
Thank you so much for having me, Bill.
You just told me you're feeling a little numb.
I just can't believe it. For the United States to miss out on World Cup qualification when the program has carried this much momentum for so long is quite frankly stunning.
How did a Seattle Sounders player help eliminate the U.S. men's team?
The Panama national team was playing against Costa Rica in their last game in the CONCACAF hexagonal qualifying stage. And Roman Torres, Seattle Sounders center back and Panama captain, scored on 88 minutes to put them ahead 2-1 and drive the final nail into the coffin of the United States World Cup hopes.
Now, I'm no soccer expert. I do coach my 7-year-old's team. How does a center back score a goal? Isn't a center back a defensive player?
He is, and that makes it all the more wild that this happened. He got forward on a long ball towards the end of the game. It shows the desperation Panama had to get this winning goal. They were even throwing defenders forward to try and find something. And sure enough, there was Roman Torres, who's been known for, kind of some late dramatics with the Seattle Sounders, too. Scored a couple of late goals for them and assisted on others as well.
And for those who have trouble following the soccer system, we're talking about a Panama game that did not involve the United States because all of it's connected. Panama had to win. Honduras had to win. Just briefly let us know how that went down.
That's right. Yeah. So it actually took 3 different results to knock the United States out.
Yeah.
Honduras upset Mexico by 3-2. Mexico was already qualified for the World Cup and finished first in the group. And so that was a pretty big upset. Panama had to beat Costa Rica, second in the group. and the United States had to lose at last place Trinidad and Tobago, and all three happened.
Yeah, losing to Trinidad, that was impossible because Trinidad is terrible. How did that actually happen?
And they're out, too. They didn't have anything to play for. They didn't even play it at their main national team stadium. They played it at a backup venue that was waterlogged until the morning of the match.
I didn't know that.
The grass didn't look like it had been mowed in a week and a half. I mean, the whole thing was just an absolute farce. But on the night, the Trinidad national team looked like they were the ones with World Cup qualification on the line, not the United States.
Yes. In fact, Megan writes on KOW's Facebook page, that she is, because we asked, you know, how are you reacting? And Megan said, gutted, yet not surprised. We played with no passion. How can you not play with passion in a World Cup qualifying match?
You know, I just have to think that they already thought they had this wrapped up, that after beating Panama on Friday, they thought that they had done enough and that this unlikely scenario of two upsets in the other matches and them somehow losing at Trinidad, it couldn't possibly all come to pass. It hasn't in the last 30 years, right? There's no way it could happen now. And I think that it was that complacency. It was a series of cascading failures.
So if you're not American, you have to love this, that the complacent Americans get theirs.
I mean, it's stunning. Panama's a country of, what, 4.5 million people? Honduras, about 9, right? And, I mean, the state of Washington has 7 million people in it. It's more comparable. Our population is more comparable to either of these countries than the United States. And yet, somehow, they found 11 better soccer players than we have. It's just stunning.
A listener named Zeki tweets to us, sports can be so cruel and yet so invigorating. Congrats to Sounders Roman Torres on lifting Panama to the World Cup. Now, that's very gracious of Zeki. Are you, Stephen, conflicted about your hometown Seattle player keeping the U.S. men out of the World Cup?
No, not at all. You know, Roman Torres was the captain of the Panamanian national team before he ever got here. You expect somebody to have loyalty to their country. And to be honest, with the way that the United States played, they really didn't deserve to make it to the World Cup. If you can't win at Trinidad when it really, really matters, then you're not going to do well when you get to Russia anyways. Mm. But that being said, Panama played with a lot of heart and they, you know, scored a big upset and they deserve to go. And it's the first time they will ever go to the World Cup. And I am happy for them and happy for Roman Torres because they earned it and they deserve it.
But what will it be like in the Sounders locker room when Torres rejoins the team? Are they just loving on him or is it awkward? What?
You know, they're all professionals, right? Yeah. Like I said, they were members of their respective national teams before they ended up in Seattle. And so that's something that, you know, that's baggage they had coming in, right? Mm-hmm. You know, Jovan Jones, his little brother, scored the game-winning goal for Trinidad last night. So you have to think that there will be some awkwardness there with Clint Dempsey as well. But I think, you know, they're all professionals. They all want to win the same trophy with the Sounders when it comes to MLS Cup. And you have to hope that they will be able to set it aside and just aim for that.
How many of the Seattle Sounders are on non-American teams?
Oh, geez. They've had 10 or 11 called up in the last cycle. Gustav Svensson is a big surprise. Came over here from China in the offseason. He's actually been called up by Sweden a number of times now in their World Cup qualifying campaign.
And so is it like half or most or roughly
a third
are from other teams around the world? You mentioned Clint Dempsey, who plays for the Sounders, played for the U.S. team last night, and now he's not going to the World Cup, and he's not getting younger. Is this it for Clint Dempsey in the World Cup?
That is it for Clint Dempsey in the World Cup. It's one of the saddest things about this experience, I think, is that Dempsey had the chance to go to his fourth consecutive World Cup and to score in it potentially and accomplish something that only a handful of players ever have around the world. And he misses out on that opportunity now, and it effectively ends the career of one of the greatest national team players in our history.
So did he at least play with passion last night, his last chance, or was he complacent too?
Oh, geez.
The lackluster.
He subbed on, and so he
subbed on meaning he didn't start the game.
That's right. He came on in the second half, and you know things were already pretty desperate by the time he got there. I wouldn't say it was his best performance, but then again, you wouldn't say anybody played terribly well.
Okay, couple more questions for you. How big a deal is this for U.S. men's soccer?
Overall? Well, I'll tell you, this hasn't happened in my lifetime. For the whole time that I have been following the U.S. men's national team, U.S. soccer as a program as a whole, it's been on an upward tilt. It's been headed in a good direction. It's been getting more and more competitive on the world stage. Our domestic league keeps getting better and better, and it's just kind of been accelerating towards better things the entire time I've been following it. And waking up this morning, it was the first time I didn't have that feeling, where our game is not growing the same way it was yesterday.
This hasn't happened in your lifetime?
I'm 21. 1986 was the last time they missed out.
Thanks a lot for making me feel creaky. Okay, never ever has my guest had a U.S. men's team not be in the World Cup. Stephen Agin. A couple more things then. Tom tweets to us, need to have U.S. women's team show up at U.S. men's team training to help with restructuring. Men's team is a mess. Is that right? The U.S. women's team is the class of the country.
The U.S. women's team is the class of the world, really. I mean, they're the best women's national team on the face of the planet. And the one thing you can say for sure, regardless of any other little bit of a, I guess you could call that a little bit of a snipe at the men there.
Mm-hmm.
But I would say the women always play with passion. The women's national team has always played with passion.
Why is that? What are they doing differently?
I think most national teams play with passion, particularly with something on the line. And I think that what the United States men's national team did yesterday was just kind of an aberration. You couldn't expect it from anybody. You can pick any team out of thin air you want. They're going to play with more passion than the U.S. did yesterday.
Someone's getting fired.
I hope multiple people are getting fired. The head coach has to go for sure, Bruce Arena.
Wow.
And I think the president of U.S. soccer, Sunil Gulati, he was elected to his third four-year term in 2014. So he's about halfway through, or a little bit more than halfway through that.
The president of U.S. soccer takes the fall?
He's got to go. The United States is still stuck on this pay-to-play model when it comes to youth soccer, where we don't seek out the best talent we can find like the rest of the world does. We seek out the kids who can afford to pay for club soccer.
Oh.
I think that's a big problem, and I think it has to change, and hopefully something good will come from this, and maybe it will be that.
Oh, complacent rich kids.
Sure. Alexi Lalas said as much the other day.
Is that right? I don't know who that is, but...
Oh, I'm sorry. There was a very famous soccer commentator who went on a big rant against the U.S. men's national team about 2 or 3 weeks ago after some poor results that led up to this, fearing that this could happen. And now, sure enough, it's come to pass. And he did cite complacent soccer players.
Rich, complacent soccer-playing Americans. Stephen Agin, Seattle editor for ProstAmerica.com, host of Radio Cascadia, also has a book. He's only 21, and he has a book called Resurgence, How Sounders FC Roared Back to Win MLS Cup. Stephen, great to talk with you. Sorry you're numb, but still good to see you today.
Thank you for having me.
It's KUOW's The Record. Back in a moment. This is The Record. I'm Bill Radke. What happens if you have a family member who is mentally ill to the point that you think they pose a danger to themselves or somebody else? Mental health laws make it hard to get that person help if they don't want it. That's why a couple of years ago, the Washington legislature passed Joel's Law. It allows families to petition a judge to involuntarily commit someone. But that's still a hard case to win. Olympia correspondent Austin Jenkins introduces you to a family who found that out firsthand.
I met Denise Vermillion totally by chance at the Thurston County Courthouse.
I have a loved one who's having some mental issues, and we're trying to get some help for him, and it's been very difficult.
Vermillion was talking about her stepson from a previous marriage. His behavior over the last month had resulted in several 911 calls from neighbors. Vermillion had gotten the log sheets from the sheriff's office.
There appears to be 8 separate calls to 911 regarding different behaviors, disturbances, erratic driving.
It wasn't just neighbors who had seen concerning behavior, so had the family. Vermillion told me what happened when she tried to bring her stepson a cake on his birthday.
You know, he didn't want anything. He didn't want to take the cake. He didn't want to take the cards. And I'm like, you're going to take these. I brought them. It's your birthday. And he's screaming at me, yelling at me, I better stop saying that or else.
The day after that encounter, a neighbor called 911 to report that he was driving recklessly in their cul-de-sac. The sheriff's deputy who responded wrote in her report that he told her he was, quote, never born, and that he is a vampire and a werewolf. That was enough for the deputy to take him to the emergency room. There, a designated mental health professional evaluated him, but determined that he didn't meet the criteria for an involuntary civil commitment.
Civil commitment is the most invasive thing we can do to a person.
This is Ian Harrell, who runs the Behavioral Health Resources in Olympia. It was his staff member who evaluated Vermillion's stepson and didn't detain him. Harrell would not speak to the specific case, but he says the bar is high for involuntarily committing someone. The person must pose a threat to themselves or others or be gravely disabled. And there's a reason for this.
To take someone off the street, to force medications, and to lock them up because they're having symptoms of a mental illness, though as a family member I might want that, as a client I absolutely would never want the state to infringe on my civil rights. And so there's a civil rights balance there.
That tension is what brought about Joel's Law. It's named after a young man who was killed by the police. The law gives families the right to ask a judge to detain someone for a 72-hour evaluation. Now, Denise Vermillion was trying to use that law to get the courts to intervene with her stepson.
We're just concerned that he's going to hurt himself or hurt someone else.
But since the law took effect in 2015, it hasn't resulted in a lot of satisfaction for families. In fact, judges have only sided with families about 13% of the time. So what would happen in the case of Vermillion's stepson? After she submitted her petition, a judge scheduled a hearing for the following day. I met Vermillion at the courthouse as she arrived with her two daughters. What are you guys thinking as you walk into court for this hearing?
Just hoping that they actually give him the help he needs instead of blowing it off.
This is her daughter, Ashley.
Because it's obviously a serious need.
The court hearing was closed to the public. It lasted about 20 minutes. When Vermillion and her daughters walked out of the courtroom, I could tell they were not happy.
What happened in there?
So basically, the judge denied it because nobody's had contact with him since he was released.
Ashley explained that the judge was sympathetic, but sided with the designated mental health professional because he was the last person to see her brother. Her mom was not surprised by the outcome.
I think Joe's Laws has good intentions, but I think the criteria is a little much.
The judge did tell them if things got worse, they could file another Joel's Law petition, but as the family left the courthouse, they wondered if by then it would be too late. I'm Austin Jenkins in Olympia.
This is The Record on listener-supported KUOW. This is our fall membership drive. I'm Bill Radke. Thank you for giving us a call, 206-543-9595, or going online and making your pledge right now, KUOW.org. Will President Trump dismantle NAFTA, the North American Free Trade Agreement with Mexico and Canada? A new round of negotiations started today, and there are signs that American officials are making proposals they know Canada and Mexico would never agree to. Canada's Prime Minister Justin Trudeau is meeting with Trump today. On the line is Vancouver Sun columnist Vaughn Palmer. Hi, Vaughn.
Hello, Bill. Our Prime Minister's down there today trying to make new friends. Washington, D.C.
Yes, spoke to Congress, in fact.
Yes, went to the House Ways and Means Committee, which, as you know, is a big deal. What's really going on here, I think, is the Canadian government's increasingly concerned about the president's threat to cancel or tear up NAFTA. The talks on NAFTA are not going all that well. Canada and the United States are in two or three big trade disputes already. The Bombardier Boeing case, the softwood, and I think what you're seeing is our prime minister down there trying to make some new friends and new allies. He went and spoke to House Ways and Means. Most of the members were there. The Republican chair, Kevin Brady, was at his side. And Trudeau said, look, Canada is the United States' biggest customer for services and goods, for goods in particular. And NAFTA works both ways. It works both ways for both countries. The economies are integrated, and any serious threat to end NAFTA is bad for the economy of both countries. Yes, it can be modernized. Yes, it can be tweaked. But this cancellation stuff would be a disaster for the North American economy.
Would you paint that picture here, Vaughn? Because trade talks can seem far away. How might the end of NAFTA, if that happened, affect the people listening to you and me right now?
NAFTA's been around for 27 years, and companies on both sides of the Canada-U.S. border have developed supply chains. They move goods back and forth. They send raw materials up. They're partly manufactured in Canada. They're sent back to the United States and finished. So particularly any border state, the economies are so integrated that just ending NAFTA and going back to the higher tariffs we had before would have huge dislocations. I think congressional leaders, particularly from border states, realize that. Maybe in some other places they don't. And the other thing, of course, that Canada is saying is, look, a lot of what the president talks about in terms of the impact on the American economy is more of a problem with Mexico than it is for Canada. Canada is concerned about becoming collateral damage.
Why would President Trump not see that? He doesn't like that the U.S. has a trade deficit with Mexico, but do we have a consistent trade deficit with Canada?
Well, we've got problems. I think it's more selective. You know, for example, I mean, it's not to say there aren't issues. The Republican chair of the House Ways and Means Committee, Kevin Brady, welcomed Trudeau today, but he said, look, you folks up there have got a big problem with dairy. You've got very high access barriers, and American dairy producers would like access to your market. Cultural industries. We don't have clean hands on this. And I think if it were single issues or two or three things that needed to be tweaked, I think Canada and the United States could make progress. The great fear up here is that against the backdrop of what Trump has been saying and doing, the whole deal might get thrown into the dumpster, the treaty that is, and that would be huge and a lot of unforeseen impacts. I don't think anybody's even thought through all the things that would happen if NAFTA itself were scrapped.
So you said Prime Minister Trudeau was in Congress, but he's also meeting with President Trump as well, right?
Yes, he is. They have a pretty good personal relationship. I think that's true. Interesting, though, they're meeting for an hour. Last time they did a joint press conference, this time there won't be one. The president is off to do a speech, doesn't have the time. Trudeau will be doing his own press conference solo at the Canadian Embassy there on the main mall in Washington, D.C. So we'll get a report of everything that happened. But as I said, I think there's a fair level of anxiety here in Canada because of the rumblings that are coming out of both the talks and the White House and the possible long-term impact on the Canadian economy and the whole North American economy as well.
Vancouver Sun columnist Vaughn Palmer, thanks for filling us in.
Okay, bye-bye, Bill.
And by the way, President Trump's comment today after chatting with Trudeau was, we'll see what happens. It's possible we won't be able to make a deal, and it's possible that we will. Hey, you know, we talk so much about newcomers in this booming region. Who are these newcomers? Why have they come, and what do they think of their new home? Will you join us for Ask a Newcomer coming up next month? We're going to get a dozen newcomers and a dozen curious people who want to know more. You have one-to-one conversations until you've all met, and we have a group discussion and a meal. So sign up. Go to KUOW.org/ask and sign up for Ask a Newcomer. This is KUOW, listener-supported radio.